5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Kimberly Atkins-Store, Barb McQuaid, Jill Winebanks, and me, Joyce Vance. We'll jump straight into the show today. You know, it's the close to the end of the Supreme Court's term, lots going on, and we have a lot to talk with you about, including Louisiana's new law that puts the Ten Commandments in every public school classroom, the Supreme Court's decision in Rahimi, the gun case, Friday morning. And we also have a treat for you. Our resident Supreme Court expert, Kim, is going to talk with us about inside details and how the court works. And finally, we'll take on a piece in the Wall Street Journal that argues Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg is actually helping Trump because the case he convicted him in is legally unsound. So that's where we'll head this week. But before we get there, I wanted to note that Monday is an important anniversary. It's the second anniversary of Dobbs, the case that reversed Roe versus Wade. And just because I know that's going to be a tough day for everybody, I wanted to check in with you guys in advance and ask how you're going to handle that holiday. Jill, what about you?
Well, I won't be celebrating it. That's for sure.
That's for sure.
And I'll be worrying about what is happening after Dobbs and the rights that are being taken away and threatened and the things that they said, well, we're not deciding contraceptives now, and now they are. I worry about the expansion of the theory of Dobbs. And I think we're seeing more and more bad things that are very upsetting. The one good piece of news is that I do think that this will be a reminder before the November election that there's a lot at stake in who will be appointing the next Supreme Court justices, and that it will encourage everyone, Because remember, Dobbs affects not just women. It affects the men who impregnated them. And I think that everybody should be concerned and worried and vote based on that.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me too. Kim, what are you thinking about?
I'm thinking on the same lines of Jill, and the one thing that I hope to do a better job of as a communicator is really impressing upon people that this goes so far beyond abortion. The implications of what Dobbs has wrought can go all the way to contraception and IVF, things that we've talked about here, but also things like the standard of care, of emergency care. With Dobbs, especially in southern states, this is impacting the way medical care is taught in medical schools. It's affecting clinical programs and their ability to teach new doctors and other medical practitioners how to handle a situation if there's an emergency with somebody who is either pregnant or of reproductive age in order to protect their fertility and their health and their lives. We could be getting everyone can get worse care because of what this opinion is doing. So it is important to vote. It is important to remember that even if you are in a blue state where Roe has been codified, that this still can impact you and that there is still a lot of work to be done.
You know, I'm going to transcribe every word you just said and make myself a checklist, because one of the things I want to do is try to have conversations, especially with younger women. Increasingly, I'm aware that, you know, we assume everybody knows this. I think that's not true. I think there are a lot of people who don't know. The New York Times had a recent poll that said 17% of Americans blame Joe Biden for losing abortion rights. So we have a lot of education to do. Jeez. I'm going to use the Kim Atkins Store checklist to get started. Barb, what are you thinking about?
Well, first, I'm thinking that now we have 2 years behind us to look at what Dobbs has wrought. And when the court said, you know, it is time for the court to get out of the business of abortion cases, you know, as we said at the time, this is just going to open the floodgates, because different states are going to try different tests, you know, the Comstock Act and Mifepristone and, you know, all these different kinds of things that are going on in all the states. So it's going to be a mess. It's going to be chaos. And it's going to be years before all of that shakes out. But, you know, I'm also reflecting that it's no coincidence that women's rights really took off in the early 1970s when we, you know, finally there was availability of both the pill and abortion was legalized. Right? It's no coincidence that we saw a convergence of, you know, women having career opportunities and making achievements once they had the ability to control their bodies. And, you know, I've been reading that so much of this current movement is actually pushed by the religious right, who thinks that we are seeing destruction of the family unit because of women who are exceeding their traditional roles, that women are to blame for all of the woes in society. And if we could just take away women's reproductive rights, we could get everything back to the good old days that like they were in the 50s and before. And to me, the right to abortion is just a fundamental right about controlling one's own destiny that is critically important for women in society.
Can I just add, Barb, that to what you said, as someone who was at the prime age to benefit from the early 70s opening of opportunities to women, I know how important these things are, and it does scare me that there aren't more young women engaged in this fight and young men, because it will affect their lives. And the expansion of the concept into IVF and contraceptives is even more terrifying to me. But this was all very predictable because the conservative right-wing religious viewpoint has spent all that time working to get to this exact moment. And honestly, we Democrats and liberals or independents have not done enough to build defenses to that. A friend of mine made a movie called Birthright, a war story, years before Dobbs, which predicted all of these things, including, as you were saying, people don't even know how to do abortions anymore. So in an emergency situation, they're not learning that in medical school and couldn't help you. So I think this is a really big, big problem and a big anniversary that should be a reminder for how to vote.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Have you heard the commandment of thou shall not combine church and state?
Well, neither have the folks in Louisiana, because a bill signed into law in that state this week makes it the only state to require that the Ten Commandments be displayed in every classroom in public schools and state-funded colleges. The law requires a poster-sized display of the Ten Commandments in, quote, large, easily readable font, end quote, by next year. I'm going to wager a guess and say that the sisters are all in consensus that this law stinks to high constitutional heaven. See what I did there? And the ACLU is also suing, so we have a legal challenge on our hands. So Jill, make it make sense. What does the Constitution say about, you know, something like religion in schools? And how strong do you think the ACLU, their argument is as this makes its way through the courts?
So first, let me say, I cannot make sense of the Louisiana law. The only thing that makes sense is the ACLU suing. And I also want to note for my sisters, you can see me, I'm wearing a separation of church and state pin,
nice,
which a wonderful jeweler had designed for me a long time ago without my knowing that Louisiana was going to do this. So I think that he was prescient in sending this to me. But in terms of the rest of this, I mean, it seems clear to me that the First Amendment says there shall be no establishment of religion by the government. And that was one of the reasons that the pilgrims came to America, was to escape enforced religion. So it doesn't make sense that they could require a thing that is related to some religions, but not all. And particularly in schools where you have, I think, more pressure in an environment where you're required to be there. I mean, going to school is mandated, so it's not like you're free to come or go. You have to be there. You don't have to be at a ball game singing or pledging allegiance, for example, which I think we'll get to later about under God being in the pledge. But to have to be reading the Ten Commandments, and there's also an issue about which version of the Ten Commandments. There are more than one in terms of the order and the phraseology. And this is not the first time this issue has come before the court. And they have been clear that you can't do it, that it is forcing people to do things that they shouldn't have to be forced to do, that it is the establishment of a religion, and that it violates the Constitution. So I think that it should be struck down fast, but this is this Supreme Court where when they want something to happen, it doesn't go the way precedent would predict. So I think it's very scary, but I think the ACLU has obviously got precedent on its side. There's, you know, Stone versus Graham from 1980, and there's a Lemon case which set the test back in 1971. So this is not a recent thing. This is, you know, more than 50 years old. And it seems to me that those cases set a precedent which this particular law cannot withstand, that there's no secular purpose. If they only publish something about you can't commit murder, you can't be a thief, that's, no, you know, those are civil things. But adultery, worshiping God, observing the Sabbath, those are religious, and they shouldn't be in a classroom.
Yeah, Barb, you know, Jill is absolutely on the money, to borrow a phrase from Joyce, on that. But we have seen recently the blurring of the lines between church and state in some recent Supreme Court rulings. You know, we've talked about these. The court issued an opinion siding with a coach who wanted to pray on the sidelines before games, a public school coach. And, you know, students were welcomed, and some would, some argued that they felt compelled to join in on that. They ruled in favor of allowing public funds to be used as tuition reimbursements for religious schools. In my adopted hometown of Boston, there was a policy that allowed people to fly a flag, but when the city tried to stop a religious flag from being flown, and it wasn't even Martha Ann, it was somebody else flying a religious flag, the city was not able to stop them. They said that that was religious discrimination. So, you know, this law, I think, was made to end up at the SCOTUS. How do you think it'll do once it gets there?
Yeah, you know, you're right about some of these recent cases. The case of the praying coach, remember we talked about that one. I think the case was called Kennedy, that it was a football coach who would take a knee on the 50-yard line after the game to pray. What it seems to me in those cases that we're talking about is the court worked really hard to find ways to distinguish it from what is clearly unconstitutional. And that is the establishment of an official religion by government, which would include public schools. And so, you know, in the Kennedy case, I thought it took a lot of work to get there, but the way they distinguish it was to say this was a private act, a private prayer. It was not official, despite, you know, the fact I disagree with their decision there. The Boston flag case, you know, what they said there was that City Hall was allowing private groups to fly private flags of any kind they wanted, and it wasn't really the city of Boston flying it. They just offered up their flagpole to any and all comers, and they couldn't discriminate against religion if they were allowing everybody else to put their flag up there. Again, seemed like a real stretch. This one, though, is so on point with the Stone versus Graham case that that Jill just talked about. I mean, absolutely straight up case in 1980 where the Supreme Court said you cannot post the Ten Commandments in public schools because it sends this message of you know, establishing Christianity as the premier religion. One of the things that the Louisiana law tries to do to make this a little different is they've got this like statement of concept that has to be posted alongside of it. And I don't think it makes it better. I think it makes it worse, because what it says is we are simply trying to teach our students the origins of all law. And so it's important that they know that the origin of all law comes from Moses bringing them down from the mountain from God. You're like, no.
Wait a minute.
That's worse. That's worse.
Well, and you know, though, Barb, I think you're so right about that. And the one thing I just want to add is this. It's like they're appealing to this whole, you know, tradition and history rubric that the Supreme Court is using to make decisions. And they're going to point to that paragraph and say, this is part of the history and tradition of the United States.
My goodness. Are they actually going to put this up like where Western Civ is taught? Because, you know, Hammurabi would like a word. Joyce, this gets us to comments that Sam Alito has been making over the past couple of years, especially since the Dobbs opinion. And I don't just mean the surreptitiously recorded conversations at a conservative cocktail party. He's been saying this out in the open at speeches in front of the Federalist Society, that crazy speech he gave right after Dobbs in Rome, where, you know, religious rights are under assault in this country. Clearly not. We just laid out a bunch of opinions where religious rights were, you know, very, very strongly protected by this court. But he is sort of openly embracing not just a pro-religious view from the bench, but a pro-Christian view from the bench. And that's apparent even in the Dobbs opinion. So given his views, do cases like this making their way up to the court pose any sort of ethics or conflict problem?
For Sam Alito, no. you know, they would for any right-thinking judge. I mean, we all know this. This isn't difficult stuff. This situation gives us context for understanding why judges shouldn't do what Sam Alito has done over these past years, aligning himself publicly with Christian nationalist views. And I think you're right, Kim, when you point out it's not just these recent surreptitious tapes we've heard. He just says this stuff openly and in public, and that's why he said it at the Supreme Court Historical Society dinner to a virtual stranger. He is entangled with this. This is who he is, and he sees nothing wrong with it. And here's the problem. No matter how he votes in the Louisiana case, if it reaches the court, his vote will be suspect. Either he'll be seen as voting his personal views without regard to the merits of the case, or he'll be seen as taking a face-saving vote if he votes against it. And we are entitled to better from our judges. We are entitled to umpires who call the balls and the strikes, and that ain't Sam Alito. You know, a former Alabama Supreme Court justice went a few steps further than Alito. He got a 2.5-ton sculpture of the Ten Commandments and had it placed in the court's rotunda, and then he refused to remove it. It was Roy Moore, who some of you may remember. He ran against Doug Jones for the Senate and lost in a race where it was revealed that he had an interest in young girls. And so Roy puts his sculpture of the Ten Commandments, which he calls the Rock, in the rotunda, and two courts order him to remove it, and he refuses to. He invokes God's law and says, it's staying. Of course, ultimately it went, and so did Roy Moore, but this is what the Constitution is intended to prevent. All that history and tradition that Alito likes to refer to, the Founding Fathers were against the establishment of any one religion, and really of any religion at all, at the founding. So while this should pose an ethical issue for Alito, as long as the justices operate in this accountability-free zone with no ethics code, it just won't.
So I want to ask you guys about all of the, but what about, right? When we're talking about this, what about the fact that we say under God and the Pledge of Allegiance, or the fact that the word God is on our money, or even when at each Supreme Court session, right? You hear the crier say, oh yay, all those having business between the Honorable Supreme Court, draw near so that you may be heard. God save the United States and this honorable court. Like, God's all over the place in our all over our government. So how's that different than what's happening here? Anybody?
Well, I think those cases, there have been challenges to those cases, and there is language in them about our Judeo-Christian origins at the founding. I think those cases are wrong. I also think those cases were decided at a time when the bulk of the population was Christian and Jewish. And I think that, you know, the multiculturalism of society, I think, has to make room for the idea that we have people of many faiths and no faith. So I do think, though, Kim, that you raise a good point, which is there is language from prior Supreme Court precedent that could be used to uphold what they're doing today. But, you know, just imagine, I saw this posted somewhere online that, you know, some school wanted to post the Quran as the supreme law, you know, Sharia law, all of these kinds of things. People go crazy over that. But I suppose the argument comes back to the religion at the founding contains those traditions that we're permitted to continue today. But I just don't see how you square that with the Establishment Clause.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I believe some defenders of this say, well, you know what? There is history and tradition of using the Ten Commandments. I mean, look at the Supreme Court building itself. Among its frieze, in its marble, in the courtroom, there is an image of Jesus, which is true. But A, the Supreme Court building was built in 1932. It was not at the founding. That's the one point. Secondly, do you know what else is in there? Confucius. And actually, I know that there is an image of Muhammad in there, which is a big no-no in Islamic religion. You're not supposed to make any actual physical images of Muhammad. And the Supreme Court had to like explain itself saying, well, it was just meant to be an honor to all of the, you know, great thinkers of our history. So you got a lot going on in there, but somehow I think if, you know, we passed a law somewhere that required the Quran to be displayed in a classroom, it wouldn't get the same treatment. What do you think, Joe?
Well, I think everybody knows my opinion, which is that I am offended enormously by particularly the Pledge of Allegiance, which added in 1954 under God. So when I first went to school, it wasn't part of the pledge. And as far as I'm concerned, it still isn't. Mm-hmm. I will not say those words. And it has nothing to do with whether I believe or don't believe. I feel I'm free to believe or not believe. And so it just offends me that under God is on our money. Under God is, you know, in the Pledge of Allegiance. And I just think it's wrong. And I agree with Barb that really right-thinking Supreme Court would, and I don't mean right in that sense, a correct-thinking Supreme Court would agree with us and would agree that the Ten Commandments, once again, cannot be put in schools because they did already decide that once, and that they would agree that maybe our money should be printed without under God and that our Pledge of Allegiance should have it taken out.
You know, and something we never think about here, but that I remember, I've talked about this before when Barb and I were U.S. attorneys, I hosted one of a series of religious roundtables that were held across the country. Mine was about the workplace. And one of the participants was a gentleman who was representing atheists. And when it was his turn to speak, he very gently said, you know, I speak for the 20% of Americans who do not have the gift of faith. And it was sort of, I mean, I'm embarrassed in hindsight that it was astonishing to me the numbers of people involved, but even if it was just 2 or 3% of the population, they are entitled to have their views appreciated and not to have religion crammed down their throats. And you know, I just think that that's something that we often lose sight of.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Thank you.
On Friday, the Supreme Court issued 5 of its 18 remaining decisions. Let's go, Supreme Court. You can do it. In a case called U.S. versus Rahimi. This was one of the big cases we've been waiting for. It's a very important Second Amendment case. And Joyce, I believe this was the one way back in, you know, the beginning of the term, was the one you identified as the one you were most watching, right? So tee this one up for us. What's the case about and how did it get to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, you know, that was back in that kindler, gentler era before we knew that Donald Trump wasn't going to go to trial. Oh, the naivete. But this is a really interesting and important case. Mr. Rahimi was indicted by federal prosecutors for violating 18 U.S.C. 922G. Look it up. It's a statute that makes it a felony violation for certain categories of people to possess firearms. So this is a criminal case. Included in 922G are felons, aliens who don't have legal status, drug users like Hunter Biden, and as in this case, people under domestic violence restraining orders. Rahimi's conduct was particularly heinous. My father-in-law, who was a judge, used to call this the no good son of a rule. But literally, that's what the judges would call
Putting
it.
My hands over my ears right
this
now.
This is a case where the facts are so bad, you know, that you don't want to give Mr. Rahimi a break. Nonetheless, he deserves the same careful consideration of every other defendant. But Rahimi repeatedly fired shots at an ex-girlfriend and threatened her with more if she called the police, used a firearm in connection with other incidents. Fortunately, Mr. Rahimi's girlfriend was not intimidated, and she did call the police. So here's Rahimi's argument that got this case to the Supreme Court. He argued that after Justice Thomas's opinion in Bruin, it was unconstitutional to interfere with his right to possess a firearm. You know, Justice Thomas wrote that no restrictions on gun rights were justified unless they were part of the history and tradition of our country at the founding. The Fifth Circuit agreed with Mr. Rahimi, and they reversed his conviction. And so that's the issue that went up to the Supreme Court, whether a person's gun rights can be restricted if a court issues a domestic violence restraining order against them.
Yeah. Okay. So history and tradition is what it's all about after Bruin. And so Jill, on Friday, we get the opinion. And what did the court hold in this case?
Well, luckily, in an 8-1 decision, which is rare these days.
You can only guess who the one was, right? Everybody.
Well,
everybody
let's say it all together.
Ginny Thomas.
Thomas.
It was Ginny Thomas.
Writing in dissent.
She wasn't on. I think that's the actual answer, but on my bingo card for who did it. But anyway, Justice Thomas did have a very lengthy dissent. And there were multiple concurrences. So this is a really hard answer to give in terms of what did the court hold, because you really have to go through all of the nuances. But the bottom line is they held that he could be barred from having a gun. He met all of the tests, they said, because he had a domestic violence restraining order issued against him with a finding that he was a danger to either domestic partner or a child, and in this case, to both, because the person who brought the complaint and got the restraining order was the mother of his child as well. And as Barb mentioned, or Joyce, I guess, mentioned, these were some
You're
of the most...
You're not confusing us, are you?
No.
You wouldn't do that.
Oh, God, so sorry. As Joyce mentioned, these were about the most egregious set of facts that you could possibly have, which made it really one of those perfect cases where the facts just scream for you have to do something about this, because he was not only threatening her, he was witnessed by someone who he shot at because he had witnessed it. And so the facts were really, really, really strong. And they went through sort of the history of what could be imposed, what had historically been imposed. And certainly Justice Thomas in his dissent went through and said, oh no, those aren't relevant. They aren't analogous. But the court said they don't have to be identical. The Constitution is not frozen in amber. And I think one of the more interesting questions in this decision is, what does it mean in terms of originalist theory in terms of how you interpret the Constitution, in terms of being, you know, arguing that it only is law that can be put into place now if it was law back then. So we're looking at laws about domestic violence when women were chattel. We belonged to the men. No man could rape his wife. There was no EEOC. There was no women's rights at all when the Constitution was founded. So of course you can't say how the court would have ruled about whether or not a person was eligible to have a gun. And there were some cases and some statutes that were talked about from England, you know, which is the basis of our law, the common law, that did allow restrictions. And so I think it's clear from this holding that the Second Amendment is not inviolable, that it does have some exceptions built into it, and that there's an interesting split in the court as to how you define what the history is and how much you allow of the changes. When you talk about a urban dangerous area, it's not the same as what we had when the Constitution became law, when the Second Amendment was passed. We didn't have urban cities. We had very few people miles apart, and we had muskets. And so I think this makes clear.
Hell no, Aaron Burr was kind of a menace. He was running around the streets.
Yeah, that's right. With his one shot.
But that's the point. He got one shot with a musket and couldn't reload. So I think things are different now, and that the civil violence that is now being dealt with by laws like the one involved here should be guidance that not only can those with a domestic violence writ against them be disallowed, but that other people who present a danger to the public can also be denied the right to have a gun, and that it doesn't take a criminal conviction for assault to say that you're a convicted felon and can't have a gun, but that when you are a danger, you can be prohibited.
Yeah, there's a part where Chief Justice Roberts, who writes this majority opinion, I think is working hard to have it, to sort of squeeze out this compromise. Because remember in the Heller case, one of, to me, the most egregious violations and cherry-picking examples of originalism and, you know, textualism and all that is where the government, that was the case where the Supreme Court held that the right to bear arms is a personal right and kind of, you know, regardless of this whole militia nonsense, you know, right to a well-regulated militia. They said that when the government said, yeah, you know, back at the founding, after all, a gun was a one-shot musket. So that's what they were talking about then. So if we're going to engage in originalism, then these restrictions against more dangerous guns certainly don't apply. You know, assault weapons, AK-47s, all that sort of stuff. And the court just waves it away like, oh, even though these guns weren't invented at the time, the word arms should be used for any arms, no matter what form that may take into the future, which is so different from what their normal originalism, textualism is. But what he says today and in this opinion is, well, just as we have this expansive definition of what is an arm, we can also take an expansive definition of what the law was allowed to prohibit back at the founding. And since they were able to prohibit dangerous people from having guns, even if the danger wasn't about domestic violence, because we'll speak in general terms, then this is okay too. So I don't know. It's I think I'm not sure I like that trade-off, because I think the musket argument it actually is more valid than they claim. Well, we've talked about where we've been. We've talked about where we are. And Kim, I want to ask more about where we're going and how this case might bode for future cases involving gun restrictions. And we get some interesting concurring opinions here that talk about sort of the real life practicalities of these things. Hunter Biden is out there with an appeal of his conviction possessing a gun while using illegal drugs. What are your thoughts about going forward about how this case is going to sort of shape the law going forward?
I mean, search me. I mean, essentially, search me is the paraphrase of Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's concurrence, who points out, like, you know, as Jill said, this is an 8-1 opinion, but it really is, when you look at it, a 2-2-1-1-1-1 opinion because everybody came at, it's like choose your own constitutional analysis because everybody had a different, I mean, you can see now why this case, I mean, it was argued back in November, you know, it should have been decided. And we're just like, where is Rahimi? Why is it taking so long? It seemed pretty clear from oral arguments that they were not going to rule in Rahimi's favor. The only question was how they were going to twist themselves into constitutional pretzels to say that you can actually have a law that restricts somebody very dangerous like him from having a handgun while he's under a protective order. And they did not find a standard for that. They found like five different standards for that. And Ketanji Brown Jackson said in her concurrence that, you know, I'll quote a little bit from it. Says the court, she says, the court should be mindful of how its legal standards are actually playing out in real life. We must remember that legislatures seeking to implement meaningful reform for their constituents while simultaneously respecting the Second Amendment are hobbled without a clear workable test for assessing the constitutionality of their proposals. And courts, which are currently at sea when it comes to evaluating firearms legislation, need a clear, solid anchor for grounding their constitutional pronouncements. The public, too, deserves clarity when the court interprets our Constitution. And basically, she comes to the conclusion that this is about as clear as mud. She said Bruin was decided before she got here. So it's like, y'all broke it already. And now you want us to try to interpret it so that other people can interpret it. And look what we did. We gave you a big gobble of mess. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then Justice Sotomayor is like, look at Clarence Thomas over there. Like, this is where if you take Bruin to its natural conclusion, you get that Clarence Thomas conclusion that says the only thing you can do about a domestic abuser with a gun is surety laws, which just allows him to pay a fine and go about his way with his guns. Like, it's crazy, right? So this really leaves, it really does leave the nation at sea in trying to figure out what constitutes a reasonable gun regulation. We know that can happen sometimes, but when, who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it leaves no clarity. I do like your use there, though, of the choose your own adventure. It's like Mad Libs Supreme Court opinion, right?
Second Amendment. Fill in, Mad Libs.
Yeah. Fill in here history, your favorite history or tradition. Back in the Scalia days, fill in here your favorite disdainful adjective. Remember, he'd use those like tiddly widdly.
What were some of those?
Yeah, he loved those kind of. All right. Well, why don't we move on from this case? Because one of the things that we thought might be useful today, you know, in our conversations and our text chains, so often we are trying to figure out what the court's going to do next. And we ask Kim, our resident Supreme Court expert, about some of the behind the scenes workings of the Supreme Court. And we thought it might be useful to educate our listeners a little bit about how to be more educated court watchers. And so, Kim, we've got a round of questions for you, and it helps shed some light on how the court works, which will help us all be better court watchers. So I'll ask the first one. The court has about a dozen cases remaining. Explain for us what the court's typical calendar is. When is school out for summer? Don't they have like free fishing trips they need to get to? Why are they still there?
Well, they do tend to have plans in summer and they do like to get to them. You know, sometimes the justices will teach at, you know, colleges in far-flung areas of the world and do other things. But typically, the term ends when the court says it's over. That usually happens by the end of June. And then they have one final cleanup conference right before they head off. And that is sometime before the July 4th holiday. So generally speaking, I would have say by next Friday, all the opinions should be released. But as you said, not only are there, you know, about a dozen still pending, and there's only one announced opinion day so far next week, and they're all really, really big cases. My guess is this could go into the first part of July. That cleanup conference is scheduled for that Monday, July 1st, and I would not be surprised if that is also an opinion day. And that's very rare for that to happen. But the more bottlenecked these opinions get, and they are getting more bottlenecked year after year after year, the more likely that this is spilling over a little longer than normally it is. Normally it does.
So, you know, I've got questions too. And it was funny, Kim, because I was flying this morning and I had horrible Wi-Fi, but I managed to get enough to see that there were four cases. And I was like, okay, we're done here, you know, and got off the plane only to have you text me. No, Rahimi is there. There's a fifth one. And I mean, this is pretty interesting. You know, among my questions are, do the justices deliberately hold back some of the more politically charged cases for the end? Because we seem to see that every year. I mean, why isn't there a decision in the Trump immunity case yet?
This is a great question. This is maybe the number one thing I got asked on Threads this week is this the court trying to delay justice, slow walk it, or even to dump unpopular opinions off on a Fridays, you know, before they get out of town or at the end of the term? The answer is no. Listen, there are plenty of things that this court is doing that is all kinds of shenanigans involved in what they're doing, and it's a lot of bad news. But let's focus on the things that the court is really doing bad. The truth is, this court doesn't have it together enough to execute that kind of a political plan. And I will tell you why. And it is a reason that has to do with politics, honestly. So for most of the time that I covered the court, regardless of the ideological bend of the court and the individual justices, there was like a center of consensus builders on this court who would say, look, even if we don't agree on an issue and particularly in very contentious cases, if there was any room for compromise or consensus, if our views, if the Venn diagram, for example, if our circles overlapped at all, could we write a narrow opinion just in the part that overlaps, make it very focused, and then build a bigger consensus? And that way you don't have as many concurrences or dissents for sure. And that allows you to decide the case. Somebody writes the opinion, you circulate it faster because you know you're starting from a basis of some consensus there, even if you don't get to all of the issues or you don't issue as broad of an opinion as the litigants were asking you to, and then you get things done. And those used to be made up of justices like Anthony Kennedy, Stephen Breyer, Elena Kagan was a big part of that at the time, and many times the Chief Justice John Roberts too, even if they weren't in agreement, they could find consensus. That consensus building center is gone. It's gone. I mean, Elena Kagan is still there. She has sort of, from the bench, expressed exasperation at the way this court is acting. She's been very honest about it. So she seems to have given up. The chief is over there. I don't know what he's doing. But what you end up with are opinions like Rahimi, where there are five different constitutional rationales for one opinion that should have been eight justices. You could have narrowed in on something that people can agree upon and then move on, and the opinion could have come out in like April. But because the court is so, everyone's on their own island with their own agenda because of the politicization of this court, among other things. I think the Dobbs leak didn't help at all. That you see these justices basically working on their own. They are not playing well together. And that makes it so much longer to circulate an opinion. I mean, this with five concurrences, that's why it took so long. That each concurrence has to go around. Everybody reads it. Everybody gets to say something. Then in their own concurrences, they can respond to the concurrence or the dissent and then come back and make an appointment. I mean, that takes for freaking ever. And that is what is slowing down all these cases. That tax case earlier this week that should have taken 10 minutes, all of them take too long. And the most contentious cases take the longest. So those are the ones that come at the end. So as soon as we heard that the court granted cert on the immunity case, I knew it would probably be the last opinion issue in the term. Not because the court's trying to play politics, but just because the court is that dysfunctional.
Kim, that's a great answer. Thanks.
It is depressing, but it's the truth.
It is depressing. But anyway, there are so many other questions that I keep getting from people on Twitter, X, and Threads. How do you find out which days will be opinion days? When does the court announce that? And how do you get the opinion quickly? Because, you know, for most people, you go on Google and you ask for the opinion, you don't get it right away. It takes a long time for it to come out.
Yeah, so the same person in the court who announces, you know, oyez, oyez, all, you know, and calls the court to order, at the end says the court is adjourned until. And when today, when Friday, when they adjourned, it said the court is adjourned until Wednesday next. And that is going to be the next opinion day for the court. Sometimes the public, the Office of Public Information lets the reporters who cover the court know, by the way, we're going to add a Thursday opinion date if the court isn't in session. So that's all we know. So me personally, how I watch the court, because I am no longer, I used to work and be physically in the press room sometimes, and you would see the number of boxes that come out. So if it's two boxes, we're like, ooh, maybe that's like two or three opinions, like depending on how long they are, you're like guessing, right? And then you sort of know because you can see when the last opinion is coming. But now that I follow it remotely, I watch SCOTUS blog, and I'm just like most of Americans who are SCOTUS nerds, who they have a wonderful live blog that tells you all the information you need to know, whether there will be another opinion coming, how many boxes there are, really puts you right there in the press room with the reporters. And so I highly recommend that.
SCOTUS blog is great, but I wish the people who don't know anything would shut up, right? It's like, it's an open blog, right? So anybody can say anything. And so like the people
moderators
are like,
aren't
okay,
identified, yeah, but yes.
Yeah. So opinion is coming. You're like, okay, let's go. And then someone's like, I'm so nervous. You gotta like look through all the clutter, right?
Well, you know, look, Barb, you can always join me in purist land, because I just go to the Supreme Court website and wait for the opinions page. But the unsettling thing there is you actually don't have to refresh that. They somehow just pop it in. So you're staring at the screen and all of a sudden you're like, oh no, there's another case. How long has that been there for? But at least you don't have to deal with the commentary from the hoi polloi.
Yeah. That's funny.
Well, I've got another question for you, Kim. Can you explain how the justices are assigned to author particular opinions?
Yes. So in every opinion, if the Chief Justice is in the majority of the case, then he assigns the case to be written by someone in the majority, including it could be, he could assign it to himself. He wrote the Rahimi decision, for example, the main opinion in that. If the Chief Justice is not in the majority, then the senior most justice in the majority assigns the case either to himself or herself or to another justice. And that can, you know, we talked a little bit about what factors go into that. The number one factor is often how many cases the justices already have. If everybody has four and somebody has two, highly more likely that the person who only has two will get that opinion. But that, it could be any reason or no reason that that justice could have a particular thought. They could have made some sort of point in their conference that the chief or the most senior, most justice in the opinion, in the majority found compelling. But it's up to a justice, either the chief or another justice.
So Kim, most days, I think every day that I can remember recently, the court has issued more than one opinion. Can you talk about how you figure out once it's happening how many decisions we're going to get, and talk about the whole box thing and R numbers?
Yeah, I don't understand our numbers. So my husband, who has covered the Supreme Court for Bloomberg News for 25 years, knows all the lingo, can like look, can like tell like by the lighting in the room what's going to happen. I can't do that. So that's why I watch SCOTUS blog, because it's a lot easier for me. But basically what happens is a little R comes up when the last opinion of the day is being released. I don't know if it comes up on the website or if it's just internal. I don't know exactly how that works, so I'm the wrong person to ask. But usually you get an idea from the number of boxes. If it's three boxes, I usually say it's like anywhere from three to six opinions, two boxes, two to three, one box, one or two. That sort of gives you an idea.
Can I have a follow-on? Can you talk about the order that they're offered in? Because, you know, come like roughly 10 minutes apart, right? More or less. But
yeah,
who gets
not
to
anymore.
Go first?
So like the contractions,
it's been
they're
closer.
Coming 10 minutes apart.
They really are.
They're
today
coming.
They were fast.
Today
yeah.
they, yeah, it's not. So during the pandemic, they were doing this 10-minute interval thing because the justices were remote, and it just made it more convenient to do remotely. What happens now and what happens normally is the justices show up and actually announce the opinion from the bench. And it goes in reverse order of seniority, with the Chief Justice being the most senior. So if on one day, for example, you have opinions from Amy Coney Barrett, Clarence Thomas, and the Chief, it will go in that order. Amy Coney Barrett, Clarence Thomas, and then the Chief. they're announced in that order. They're not announced in the order of how big the case is. But I mean, sometimes it can be because Alito and the chief in this majority tend to write a lot of the big opinions. So it seems that way, but that's not actually how it's done.
And so, Kim, one more question for you is, how does the court decide which cases it will take? It's not mandatory that they take appeals. And we have certainly questioned some of the ones they've taken and said, why? Why did they do that? That's such an obvious outcome. They shouldn't have heard it. So what do they take into account?
Well, there are some cases that are mandatory for the court to take, and those are cases of original jurisdiction. We actually got one of those opinions this week. Those are battles between states, and they're usually over things like land or water rights. And the court takes those up as a matter of they're compelled to hear those cases, and they're heard like a trial. So the court weighs evidence and does everything. It doesn't just weigh the law as they do with other appeals. But aside from that, the court grants what is known as certiorari, and I'm sure we all pronounce that differently, but that basically is the court deciding on itself, we are going to answer this case. They get untold requests every year, and lately the court has been granting maybe 50 to 60. When I covered the court in the beginning, they used to do like 70 or 80, so that's numbers really come down, even though they still can't manage to finish them all in a timely manner. They usually take up a case either where there is a split among the circuits, which means the courts of appeals are coming to different opinions, and that's not good for the rule of law and reliability, or it's a novel constitutional issue, like whether the president is immune from prosecution, or something that needs clear clarification by the court. Again, they can do it for any or no reason, but those are the cases that are most likely to be taken up, and it takes four justices to agree to take up a case. So they don't need a majority to agree, but four justices have to agree. Whoa, that was exhausting. That was like mini law school.
Well done.
You did great. I mean, I know we sort of imposed on you to do this, but you're my go-to person. So I think you should be everyone's go-to person.
I'm happy to do it, you guys.
Five years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
So the Wall Street Journal this week had a very provocative opinion piece. It's not the first time the Wall Street Journal or any other Trump-supporting media have assailed the New York State convictions resulting from DA Bragg's business records case. They have claimed from day one that the case is not justified, and they're going to continue to make such claims. But this Wall Street Journal article written by Michael McConnell was arguing that the convictions are actually helping Trump because the case is legally wrong. I want to focus on the legal arguments made here, not the political implications, because some of those legal arguments may actually sound reasonable to even smart and thoughtful attorneys. A good friend of mine wrote me as soon as she read the article saying, what are the answers to these claims? Because she really thought they sounded reasonable. So I want to help my friend Linda and our audience understand why the arguments in this new hit piece or opinion piece are wrong and why the case is legally correct. And Kim, so let's start with making sure that everybody listening knows what the piece claimed is illegal about Bragg's case. And then if you would use your Supreme Court expertise some more today and put it in context by telling us about the history of how special counsels have been appointed and challenged.
Yeah. So, well, I'm going to defy your question a little bit, Jill, and sort of start with the politics and then go to the law, because I think it's really important. Because what this feels like to me, this piece, was remember during the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation when Dr. Christine Blasey Ford first came forward and then she testified so eloquently about her recollection of her encounter with Kavanaugh. And then all of a sudden, I remember seeing online this conservative legal pundit named Ed Whalen float this idea of like the doppelganger theory, right? Like that everything she said could be totally true and she's completely believable, except she got the wrong guy. Like something about her brain made her forget and misremember who did this. And I was like, how disgusting, like how insulting that you're talking about a doctor, like somebody who experienced something. Like when I have experienced something traumatic, it is like embedded in my brain forever, right? How dare you say, but all of a sudden, by the time the end of the confirmation process was done, all the senators on the Republican side, even Susan Collins, were like, oh, I think that she went through something terrible, but I think she maybe misidentified. Like, it just caught on. Like, he floated this theory, and it led the way, and Brett Kavanaugh's on the court, right? So that's why I think this McConnell guy is doing with this piece, trying to give Republicans something to rally around by floating a flimsy legal theory. And who knows? It might work the same way it did with Kavanaugh. So essentially, what he is claiming is that this was a Democratic orchestrated act of lawfare committed against Donald Trump for political reasons that is unsupported by the law. He says that the charges in the New York case for which Trump was convicted were, in his money, bogus for a lot of reasons. Hush money payments aren't illegal. In order for it to even be potentially a crime, it needs to have had been filed within the statute of limitations, which ran out in 2019. Of course, that's not true. That was for the misdemeanor. If it was a felony done in furtherance of another crime, which we've explained ad nauseum on this podcast, the statute of limitations had not run. He actually says that in here, but still. He says, because there was no other crime enumerated, then that doesn't work either. Of course, the prosecutors made clear that it was a violation of campaign finance law to hide payments before an election to keep that information from people. And that Republicans, independents, and fair-minded Democrats are therefore justified in regarding the New York case as an abuse of the system with the intention of affecting the 2024 election. Listen, Donald Trump can appeal this and make that argument. I think that it is bogus, but this is above all a political document meant to rally Republicans and use this as a rallying cry on the campaign trail. This is not a serious legal document.
So, Kim, you used the word lawfare, which now has a new definition. I mean, it was when I testified before Congress before what used to be called the Weaponization Committee. Yeah. It's now called the Lawfare Committee. And so I had to look up what lawfare meant. And it does mean the abuse of government to punish people wrongly. And it's hard for me to believe that anybody thinks that's what's going on here. But Barb, I want to go into some of the...
Oh, and wait a minute. Before you do that, you asked me another question, because he also goes beyond the New York case and assails the other cases before Donald Trump, that Donald Trump is facing based on the use of special counsel, and that special counsel is not justified here. Actually, there was a hearing today on that very point, that the special counsel Jack Smith's appointment was unconstitutional. I mean, no. There is a long precedent of special counsels. I think there have been how many have there been? Like 8 or 10? And there have been previous challenges to special counsel. So a special counsel is someone appointed by the attorney general under DOJ regulation in a case where it is determined that you need a more independent eye to make the decision about prosecution so that it cannot be tagged as being politically motivated prosecutions. That's why we've seen it happen when the classified documents case in the case of both Donald Trump and Joe Biden, when they had the classified documents. We saw that in Hunter Biden because he was a son of a political figure. I think that was a bit of a stretch, but we saw it. Merrick Garland made the decision to do it. And we see, of course, in two of Donald Trump's cases, there are special counsels there too. It is not unconstitutional. In fact, back when there was an independent counsel statute, remember Ken Starr? He was an independent counsel that was appointed under a federal statute that has since expired. One of the reasons that statute was allowed to expire is because what that essentially did was set somebody up to be in power under no branch of the federal government. They were not an executive person. They were not under the judiciary. They were not under legislative control. They were just out there kind of floating on their own. And that, I think if that was challenged constitutionally, that would be a problem. But the special counsel clearly has executive authority under DOJ regulations that have been upheld. And all of these are Hail Marys, but you know, I guess it depends on which judge you pull in the appeal as to whether these arguments will hold any water.
Barb, I want to ask you, because you've written the book about dis and misinformation. You heard what Kim laid out as some of the arguments being made. Are these arguments in the Wall Street Journal article disinformation, or do they have any legal validity? And I just want to note that the author is a law professor. He's at Stanford. He was a judge on the 10th Circuit, and he's now a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, which is officially part of Stanford, but is privately funded and has really nothing to do with Stanford. It's described as conservative.
Yeah, I'd say this is the absolute definition of disinformation, because he takes the germ of truth and states it without providing details or context in an effort to provoke outrage. You know, so, you know, he says things like the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels weren't illegal, period. Well, yeah, not standing alone. And then he says it's the labeling of those payments as legal fees that constituted the crime. But that's a misdemeanor in New York for which the statute of limitations ran out in 2019. All right, an awful lot going on there. That's because it wasn't a felony. It wasn't a misdemeanor. It becomes a felony, which converts the statute of limitations to 5 years, which got told because of COVID and because Donald Trump was absent from the jurisdiction in compliance with the law in New York. So he says some things are true, but he doesn't tell you the whole thing to put it all together. Another thing says, it becomes a felony if it's used to conceal another crime. Then he says, what was this other crime? The indictment didn't say, and each juror was allowed to choose from any of three theories. True, but it misses a lot of important information. The indictment didn't say, but a bill of particulars was filed within a few months that did say. And the other crime was a state law that prohibits the promotion or prevention of the election of a candidate by illegal means. And so it wasn't a crime, but it was the means that the jury was allowed to find without unanimity, in compliance with the law. So there's a lot of stuff in here. When he talks about selective prosecution, he doesn't say it is. He says it has the whiff or the odor of selective prosecution. And he talks about different standards for Joe Biden and Donald Trump, whose conduct was completely different. Donald Trump was not charged for accidentally bringing home some boxes of documents. He was charged because when he was asked about it, he refused to give them back for 18 months and then move boxes around to make it more difficult to find them. So I find this to be the definition of disinformation, saying a lot of things that are true, but without providing enough detail or context to give a full understanding that would be accurate.
Exactly. I mean, it seems to me that this is the definition of omission makes it untrue, and that you can say one thing, but if you don't fill in the second, it's a total lie. So Joyce, going to this sort of expansion of his argument from And I should say that this opinion is really about why Republicans are sticking with Trump. And it's because this was such a bad case. But he points out that there are other bad cases, which is every single case against Trump in his view. So they're arguing now that special counsel have to be Senate approved. And, you know, just like U.S. attorneys like you and Barb were, have to be Senate confirmed. What's the argument there and what's the answer?
Yeah, I mean, I'll add on to what Kim was saying, because I think she said it pretty eloquently, right? This is, it's an interesting argument. There are some good arguments on both sides. And down in Florida, Judge Cannon should have considered Trump's argument for about 30 seconds before she dismissed the argument, because that's how much merit it has. Instead, Friday afternoon, I think while we were taping the podcast, she was still in court hearing arguments from parties and even from amici on this, which is very interesting. But the reason it's good to know that this is happening in Florida, and here's a real good, I think, sort of laying open of the hypocrisy that's going on here. One of the amici who was arguing down in Florida, the argument was made by Ed Meese, who was the U.S. Attorney General in 1987, when he appointed Lawrence Walsh to serve as the Iran-Contra special counsel. And Meese is now arguing that Attorney General Garland didn't have the legal power to do what he himself did. So in 1987, when Meese made that appointment, the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia very quickly dismissed the argument. In fact, they said in their opinion, we have no difficulty concluding that the Attorney General possessed the statutory authority to create the Office of the Independent Counsel. And like you said, Jill, this was under a different regulation. This was under the prior regulation, but it's based in the same statutory authority that's used here. It's the same statutory authority that was used when there were a special counsel under Janet Reno. It's been in use ever since. It's very ironic that Meese is taking the position that Garland can't do it. Judge Cannon, you know, if she rules against the special counsel, at least Jack Smith will get his long-awaited opportunity to go to Atlanta. But this whole piece in the Wall Street Journal just smacks of apologia to me. I mean, I think they have to know that this, you know, a former 10th Circuit judge, way too smart to not appreciate what's going on in this piece. I think it's just a shameless exercise in trying to give people excuses for looking the other way when a former president, now a candidate to be president again, has been convicted on 34 felony counts.
Apologia.
That might be my new stage name.
That's a word, right?
I like it. Apologia.
It's sort of, you're making me think about Prince and Apollonia, right?
Yeah, it says it's cool, right?
We'll be Apologia 6.
Can we be singing Purple Rain on the way out of the show today?
I like it.
Oh, God.
Apologia. I'm going to serve that at my next picnic. Apologia salad.
Five years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Now it's time for what's really become our favorite part of the podcast, answering our listeners' questions. You know, today we struggled to decide from among a lot of great questions for the three that we could answer. So please make sure that if you have a question for us, email it to us at sistersinlaw@politicon.com. Tag us at sistersinlaw at the, you know, using the hashtag on Threads, or tweet using the hashtag on Twitter. If we don't get to your question during the show, keep an eye on our threads during the week because we will try to answer as many additional questions there as we can. But this week, first, Jill, let me come to you. We've got a question from Michelle in Enschede in the Netherlands. Is there no recourse on bump stocks? Can Congress limit these deadly devices? That's a great question.
It is a great question, and I love that it came from the Netherlands and that we have listeners there. And unfortunately, this is a quick answer. There is no recourse at the court level because this is our highest court. Can Congress do something? They may do something, but they won't because of the fact that there's no bipartisan agreement. The Democrats did try to do something because the court had really made it clear that this was an issue that could be resolved by Congress, that this was statutory interpretation and that the statute at issue just didn't hold up to what needed to be in the statutory language. So it is up to Congress, and I think it's up to our listeners to make sure they contact their members of Congress to get them to pass a law that says what is obvious to all of us, that a bump stock makes a non-automatic weapon into a prohibited weapon.
Yeah, you know, Justice Alito, even in his concurrence, invited Congress to act. I think that they should take him up on it. Kim, next question is for you, and it comes from Maggie. She asks, why is the Trump flag, his face on our American flag, both allowed and very visible? Isn't it desecration?
So before this question, I was unaware of this flag, but I did look it up just because it was brought up, and it indeed is a flag with Trump, you know, with, I believe he has a thumbs up sign or something on it. And you're asking, is it desecration? Maybe. Desecration is in the eye of the beholder, I guess. But I think the bigger point is desecration is not unlawful, at least constitutionally in our country. You can do whatever you want to a flag. You can even burn it. There are some, I think there may be some old blue desecration laws still on the books in some states, but if they were ever enforced, they would quickly be struck down as violative of the First Amendment's protection of freedom of speech, because the Supreme Court has ruled very, very clearly that such actions fall squarely within that very strong protection. So you can make a flag with your face on it if you like, but Donald Trump has the same right to do so.
Oh, okay. Barb, last one's for you from Leslie. President Biden has said that he will not pardon his son Hunter. If Hunter gets jail time, can he commute the sentence? And what's the difference between a pardon and a commutation?
Very good question. I think Joe Biden has now also said he will not commute Hunter Biden's
correct.
Sentence. So both of these are two different categories of clemency. Clemency is the president's power to grant some sort of relief when someone is convicted of a crime. And so a pardon is forgiveness. Usually under DOJ policy, a person has to serve their sentence first, and 5 years have to pass before they can apply for a pardon. And then it is a show of mercy and forgiveness. You did this thing, but we're going to take it off your... I mean, I think it still shows up on your record that you were convicted, sentenced, and then pardoned. So it is a showing of mercy for some reason, you know, giving pardoning Nixon, pardoning people who went to Canada during Vietnam, all of those things. And a pardon could occur before someone is convicted of a crime, as it was for President Nixon. Commutation is, I'm going to prevent you from serving your sentence, or I'm going to cut it short. So this is something that Donald Trump did for many of his cronies and other people who were serving sentences for public corruption crimes in particular, I believe in an effort to normalize that crime. So people like Rod Blagojevich and former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, who were serving portions of lengthy sentences, Donald Trump said, you're free to go. You know, I'm going to cut your sentences short. So those are two different things, forgiveness and cutting short a sentence. And the president has the power to do both of those things under this broad umbrella of clemency.
Thank you for listening to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Kimberly Atkins Store, Barb McQuaid, Jill Winebanks, and me, Joyce Vance. Please show some love to this week's sponsors, HelloFresh, Lola V, Calm, and OneSkin. Their links are in the show notes. Please support them not only because we love them, but because they make this podcast possible. Follow Hashtag Sisters-in-Law on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and please give us a 5-star review. It really helps others find the show. See you next week with a new episode, hashtag sisters-in-law.
I looked up the history recently of how it got in, and it was a religious conservative person who got President Eisenhower to do this. Sorry. Musical accompaniment, sorry. You can
bad to the bone. Bad to the bone. That is Jill Weinbeck.
Kind of appropriate. Kind of appropriate.
There is no better thing.
I used to have Deliverance. I used to have Deliverance as my answering song. That would have been even better.
That was fantastic.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.